Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan.
Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then we consider what you know of the news of the day. Since last year's coup, the conflict in Myanmar has escalated dramatically, exacerbated by the collapsing economy and humanitarian crisis. Now, efforts of the international community to seek a peaceful resolution have not brought any tangible progress so far, with the military regime failing to adhere to ASEAN's peace plan, which is known as the five-point consensus. Now, what can we learn about the trajectory of this conflict through the lens of human rights? Joining us now is Thomas Andrews. He is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Myanmar. Special Rapporteurs are part of what is known as the Special Procedures of Human Rights Council, which comprises the largest body of independent experts in the UN human rights system. Thomas, welcome to the show. Thank you for being with us today. We understand that you are here on an eight-day visit to Malaysia to better understand both the Malaysian and ASEAN response to the Myanmar crisis. So you've met with government officials, with MPs, with CSOs, but we also understand you've met with individuals from Myanmar communities who have fled the military's violence and are now here in Malaysia. Can you begin by telling us what you've learned from speaking with them about their experiences here?
Yes. Well, first of all, Melissa, thank you so very much, you and Sharad, for having me on this program. It really is appreciated because, you know, this is such an important issue, and so often it gets buried underneath, of course, crises going on all over the world. So I really appreciate this. You know, I've had an opportunity to meet a lot of people, as you say. It's been a very busy week. But among them are those who have left Myanmar literally running for their lives and undergoing just extraordinary difficulty, to put it mildly, to go from their community, their home, their village, often that's been totally destroyed, to getting out of Myanmar so that they can be safe, and then making their way to a place where their families and themselves can be safe. I mean, I'll tell you, one of the things that the stories were just heartbreaking. I spoke to a woman, for example, who left with her family. And at one point, you know, she went through Thailand with her elderly parents and other members of her family. And just before they were approaching Malaysia, they were told by their so-called agent that the elderly could not continue on, that it was too difficult. They were slowing everybody down, and they had to make a decision. Either they were going to have to just stay there, or they were going to have to leave their parents, elderly parents, behind, which is what they did. Another woman who was in the opposition movement, had spent time in prison, had been tortured, horrible, horrible situation, made her way out, but because of the expense of this journey, she was only able to afford the money for herself, her husband, and one of her five children. She had to leave the other four children behind because of the expense and because of the danger of the journey. So story after story of heartbreak, but here you have a people who are literally running for their lives. They've been tortured. They have faced incredible, incredible persecution, and they truly had no choice if they were going to live. And of course, life is a fundamental human right. Then they had to get out of the country, and they made their journey. So yes, it has been a remarkable week that has included many, many conversations with those who have come here just seeking the right to live.
Tom, you know, on this show, we've actually covered the question of refugees and Myanmar refugees in particular, the Rohingya as well. But what we've discovered over the many months that following the story is the inconsistency between the Malaysian government's international posturing on the question of Myanmar and human rights and its domestic practice. Is there any indication, you met with the foreign minister, you've met with people in government, any indication that they will strive or are striving to be consistent in their approach to Myanmar refugees, lessening the gap between what is said and what is done?
Well, the foreign ministry was extraordinarily helpful to me. They invited me here. Malaysia is the first ASEAN country to welcome me into the region. And the foreign minister has been very forward-leaning in challenging ASEAN, as you know, to transform this five-point consensus from a piece of paper into action. And of course, no matter what is contained in a consensus, if it remains on paper, it doesn't mean much to anybody. And the foreign minister has said, look, we should have a strategy. We should establish an action plan for this five-point consensus. We should have we should connect this action plan to an actual time frame. Because if we stick with what we're doing, well over a year since the April 2001 summit in which this plan was, this five-point consensus was established, then there will continue to be no movement. We'll be here again next year with no movement. And the consequence of this, as the foreign minister points out, is more people killed, more torture, more suffering, in short, unacceptable. So they are, as a ministry, and the foreign minister in particular has been very forward-leaning, challenging ASEAN to change course.
Yeah, Tom, but Tom, my question really is about the domestic Malaysian situation. I understand these diplomatic maneuvers are very important, but the question is, the one thing that this government is in control of is the situation, the condition that refugees who are here in Malaysia are under. They can change that, and they could change that if there was political will. And what we've discovered over the many months covering the story is there doesn't seem to be any political will to, as you put, recognize these people as victims. They are treated as criminals. They are detained under horrendous conditions. And you've probably heard of the escape of hundreds of Rohingya refugees recently. And some of them died trying to escape. That situation, is that being addressed?
No, it's not, to be perfectly honest with you. You know, I've heard a lot about these detention centers, these detention facilities. I talked to people here who had relatives in them. They had no idea how their relatives were doing, where they were, if they were going to be released, when they might be released. No information whatsoever. I sought information about the policies. Literally, the first day I was here, I saw pictures of people that had been arrested at the border, lined up, holding numbers, identifying how many people had been captured. Again, desperate people, leaving an impossible situation. And so I eagerly, just as I wanted to speak with the foreign minister and the foreign ministry, I wanted to speak with the home affairs and I have an understanding of what's going on, and I'd like to visit a detention center, and I'd like to learn the complete picture. I wanted to get, again, I'm a special rapporteur. I report on the facts as I see them, and so I was unable to visit a detention center. I was unable to get a meeting with anybody in the Home Ministry. So all of these questions that I have, I'll go back unanswered, except that they are unanswered. And you know, it's the difficulty here is this. If one is not allowed in, then it just leaves it up to the imagination. What is behind those walls? What is someone trying to hide? And if I could be given access, if I could meet people there, if I could meet with officials there, well, then I would be able to see, even from their perspective, what it is that they are seeking to do, what context, nuance, whatever might be present that's important for me and the world to know. But if we're given no information and we're given zero opportunity to get that information and to have this kind of conversation, then it just leaves it up to one's imagination as to what might be going on and the reality that whatever is going on Someone does not want me to see it, which is never, right. ever a good thing.
Tom, have you noticed anything similar? What about the situation in other parts of the region, refugees who have ended up in Thailand or in Indonesia? What is the human rights situation for them there? Have you had access to speak to individuals from Myanmar who have ended up in these countries?
I have not, you know, and my plan, as I described it to the Human Rights Council, is to have that opportunity, take that opportunity and seek those conversations in Thailand, in Indonesia, in areas in which these people are literally running for their lives. I've submitted my request to come into to those countries. That request is being considered. And I'm looking forward to the opportunity to do so. But Malaysia, very quickly, was the foreign ministry was very, very happy to welcome me in, to engage in conversations. And I'm very grateful for that. And I'm looking forward to being able to answer your question because I've been in Indonesia and Thailand.
Okay, Tom, we're going to take a quick break, but after this, we'll come back and continue this conversation looking at the crisis in Myanmar. Stay tuned to Consider This. We'll be right back. Hi, thanks so much for staying with Shraddha and I on Consider This. Let's continue our conversation tonight with Thomas Andrews. He is the UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Myanmar. He's here on an 8-day visit to Malaysia to better understand both the Malaysian and ASEAN response to the Myanmar crisis. Tom, can we take a look at what's happening in Myanmar? What do you understand to be the human rights situation and how that's changed in the past 15 months, particularly in terms of the intensity and the mode of violations by the military?
It has deteriorated almost exponentially. You know, we began, the coup occurred, millions of people came out in protest. The protests were peaceful. The soldiers and security personnel stood back and let people express their will freely. But then, soldiers, police were ordered to begin firing into crowds, snipers killing innocent protesters, people, soldiers, police firing into homes at random in various neighborhoods. I know this in part because here in Malaysia, I talked to Army, Navy, and police defectors who actually witnessed the killing of innocents, who witnessed the firing on innocent homes and villages. So we know this, and then it's been deteriorating since this. I just completed and released just a few days ago a special report on the impact that this crisis is having on children. And since the coup in February of last year, 250,000 children have been displaced. 1,400 children have been arbitrarily detained by the junta. 61 children right now are being held hostages by the junta in an attempt to get their parents or one of their parents who was at large to give themselves up so that they would then be able to free their children. 142 children have been tortured. I'm sure the number is greater, but this is what we've been able to document. They have been cut, they have been stabbed, they have been burned with cigarettes, they have been forced to be in to hold stress positions, they have been subjected to mock executions, they've been deprived of food and water, they've had fingernails and hair pulled out of them. It is incredible to hear these stories, and 33,000 kids in Myanmar, children in Myanmar, are going to die this year, it's estimated, of preventable diseases because they have been denied routine immunizations. Now, these are all horrifying numbers, but I've had the chance, and by virtue of the internet, and some very brave individuals, I've been able to have conversations with people inside of the country who are experiencing the horror directly. And I'll give you one example. A man, his village, his home had been totally decimated, been burned down by the junta. And this is a huge problem, an escalating problem, as they're going from village to village, region to region, incinerating these homes. So he brings his family to an IDP center for safety. And 2 days before we had, and we had scheduled this conversation, 2 days before we had this conversation, his two only daughters, ages 12 and 15, died in their sleep because the junta attacked the IDP center with a barrage of artillery. So they were killed by an artillery shell. This is not a military position that was under attack. This was an IDP center where families and children had gone to be safe after their village and their homes had been burned to the ground. This is just absolutely unconscionable. And I'll tell you, Melissa, to have a I'm a dad, and to have a conversation with this man who was having every ounce of courage that he could muster just to be able to talk to me. It was so, so heartbreaking. And this is happening all over the country. So in answer to your question, things are deteriorating rapidly. The violence is accelerating rapidly. And it is just a tragedy on top of a tragedy.
Tom, for the international community, the mechanisms or tools they have at their disposal to either lessen or de-escalate the violence or to hold people accountable, perhaps a few and far between. But we know that in 2019, the Gambia brought a case of genocide against Myanmar in the International Court of Justice. Is what's happening now, does it constitute genocide or some sort of crime for which somebody could be held accountable?
Well, we know, at least in my view, that certainly the attacks against the Rohingya ethnic minority, Muslim minority in Rakhine State were genocidal in nature. And of course, that is what the International Court of Justice is now adjudicating. This is my view. But I think without question, in my opinion, crimes against humanity have been committed and are being committed. War crimes have been committed and are being committed. I think this must go to every mechanism, justice mechanism, that is possible. You mentioned the International Court of Justice. There's the International Criminal Court, and that could happen. The reference could happen if the Security Council would take this up. Of course, that's not going to happen anytime soon, but it's a mechanism. There's a thing called universal jurisdiction, in which there are various countries that have laws on the books that can hold hearings and trials about these very questions. Those are available. The independent international mechanism for Myanmar, the IIMM, is a mechanism that is doing forensic studies, looking at all the evidence and putting it in a form that can be used in a court of law when that becomes available. So there are various justice mechanisms that are available, but they're not accessible at this juncture in time. And what it's going to require is the political will to get us there.
Well, we spoke to Nicholas Kumjin from IIMM, and he said one of the biggest challenges is actually for prosecutors, particularly with these types of war crimes, is to establish a chain of command, a link between the crime and the leader who's responsible. And I'm just wondering, Tom, whether you've been following the case of the impending executions of Myanmar's political dissidents or political opponents, whether that constitutes as a war crime, whether what the international community can do to stop these impending executions.
Well, you know, it's horrific. You have political prisoners on death row, and their crime is to be opposed to the military junta. It's horrific, but it's also not surprising. Thousands of people have lost their lives for opposing this junta. And what's required, I think, is many things. One, international pressure. We need to have firmer, stronger international pressure. It needs to be coordinated. Countries that are willing to exert political, diplomatic, economic pressure need to do so in a targeted and strategic way. That needs to happen. Also, quiet diplomacy with those countries that have a relationship with Minh Anh and others. The Prime Minister of Cambodia has weighed in on this very question, appealing for these individuals not to be executed. But you know, it just puts in sharp relief the reality that we're dealing with here in Myanmar. And I'll tell you something. You know, someone asked a question about elections. Will there be elections in 2023? And of course, the junta is talking about elections in 2023. I mean, what a complete, absolute outrage to suggest that there is even the remotest possibility of a free and fair election in 2023 when political opponents are all in prison or they are facing the death penalty. They're on death row. So through public expressions of public outrage, the mobilization of condemnation from world leaders, including from within ASEAN, and quiet diplomacy to see if perhaps lives can be saved that way, I think any and every mechanism that's available should be used.
We understand, of course, the ethnic armies that are varying strengths who are opposed to the junta at this point in time. The Rakhine army is particularly powerful. But in the conflict between these ethnic armies and the junta, are there other types of violations happening? Are people caught in the crossfire?
Yes, there's no question about that. And you have this general atmosphere of lawlessness throughout the country. So any of the challenges that Myanmar was facing before the coup, in terms of corruption, you know, in terms of lawlessness, of criminality, of gangs, of the extraction of natural resources, rapid corruption, drug trade, all of those things that are so horrific to the functioning of a society, of a nation, they're all just, I mean, they've been unleashed in this country, in Myanmar. And all you need to have is a payout. You know, you just, it's money talks. And if you can say that you'll be deferential and loyal to this criminality, then you can get away with whatever basically you want to get away with it. So it's a bad situation on many fronts, but including the criminality and lawlessness that we see just running rapid in the country.
It's been more than a year now, Tom. The situation has, as you said, escalated. Where are the failures? Where has the international community failed? Where has ASEAN failed? Where has Myanmar's neighbors failed in terms of doing something to de-escalate the violence?
You know, let's start with, of course, with ASEAN. The foreign minister of Malaysia, Foreign Minister Safuddin, has identified himself the shortcoming, which is you have a consensus, which is an important start, but you need to take that consensus position and translate that into action. That's been the single biggest challenge right now and deficit here in ASEAN that needs to be addressed. That's number one. With the United Nations, listen, you know, I was told many times, I've been recommending that the Security Council convene to hold a session on the crisis in Myanmar. I was told, no, we can't do that because there's going to be a certain veto. So it's really pointless to proceed to the, well, the people of Myanmar who I talk to, whether there's a veto or not, want a full and open debate, want to vote up or down, and then let people be held accountable and nations be held accountable for that vote. So what happened? Well, in 4 days, the crisis in Ukraine saw a resolution before the Security Council, a veto, which everybody, of course, fully expected, needless to say, but then movement on to the UN General Assembly for an emergency special session and a full and open vote there, and then coordinated action and sanctions all over the world, including nations in this region, stepping up in a focused, strategic, coordinated way to apply maximum pressure on the source of the violence in Ukraine. So the people of Myanmar are still waiting for the same action from the United Nations Security Council, the United Nations, that took 4 days to occur when it came to the crisis in Ukraine. And they want to know why, and they have a very, very good question as to why. We can and should do a lot more than we're doing. And if we can't do it through formal mechanisms, then at least those countries who are willing to take action can do so in a much more strategic and focused way. And there's no excuse, in my view, for them not doing it. What it lacks is the political will to do so.
Well, that was our conversation with Thomas Andrews, the UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Myanmar. And that wraps up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan, signing off for the evening.
Thank you so much for watching.
And good night. We'll be right back.